Good evening, folks. It is 7:08 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Well, this half hour, we are going to visit with a couple that decided to form their own coffee company and create a nonprofit. So in other words, they are have an online coffee company, and the profits are going to charity. They live in Waconia, and one of the things they've been able to do is they've been able to cover the majority of the cost of a little girl in Haiti to remove a chunk of skin covering her eye. Now she can see out of both of her eyes. And that's the kind of work that they're doing. And I thought, let's talk to these folks about how you suddenly decide to try and kind of pull this together and get this business together, a coffee business nonetheless. So it's Brandy Seward and Steve Seward are both founders of Java Relief. They are husband and wife. And did I say your last names correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, great. Well, welcome to both of you. Explain sort of what you were doing before and how you came up with this idea. And then, you know, I think a lot of people have ideas of a business or maybe an invention, and it's the difficulty is getting it from the idea to the actual business. So what were you doing before you did Java Relief?
Well, for me, I have been a stay-at-home mom for years and years. My children are now 19 and 14. So,
and that is a lot of work.
That's a lot of work. So
the two kids, right?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
19, 14.
Shale and Jada. Yeah, so for me, it's a little bit easier to step into something different. But I'll let my husband take the part of the story here where... Okay.
And what were you doing before, Steve?
Oh, yeah, I'm in advertising. I'm a partner at a creative shop. And I have had my own business and I still do. And
so you didn't quit the day job?
I didn't.
Okay. No. I mean, that's, you got two kids, you know, you got to make sure the bills are getting
paid. Yeah. And really to make an impact with this Java Relief business, we don't draw any income from it because we want results, right? So we want to make money, but we want to make an impact to these children at risk that we have in mind.
All right.
And so this, you know, you said that, you know, how do you take this idea that you've had and actually make it a reality? Well, the reality for us is it took a long time. It was 2 years really before we finally just dove right in. And because, you know, once you dive in, you're committed, and we knew, you know, this is going to be a lot of work. And we have our normal life, so we paced ourselves and kind of just built it up. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the website.
Very cool, yes. JavaRelief.com.
Thank you, yeah.
And so that took a lot of time. You know, there's a lot of thought and effort. Yeah. And we have to source out, you know, where are we going to get this coffee, you know, and who are all our vendors and what's the packaging design look like and how are we going to market this, you know, through social media. And it's really, you know, it's been 3 months. So we're just, we're learning as we go, but it's been really, it's been super fun for us because we're doing this together, my wife and I, and we're just super passionate about what we're doing.
And you haven't killed each other yet.
Not yet.
you've got two teenage kids. There's a lot going on. But let me ask you this. How did you choose? So did you know from the start that it would be coffee or that you just knew you wanted to find some kind of nonprofit to raise money to help others?
Yeah. Yeah. And Esme, part of the story, too, is that we've been doing mission trips overseas for 20 years at least. And have seen a lot of terrible circumstances that children live in. And so that, too, was part of the buildup of, okay, finally it hit us. We cannot go back home and live normal again. We have to do something. And as Steve has kind of figured out, and it's true, is that the whole world drinks coffee.
Yes, I would agree. Just about everybody does.
Yeah, and everybody, you know, you can eat different foods in different countries, but coffee is such a common denominator. And, of course, it's such a hot button in the States, especially now. So, yeah, it's just a...
So you thought, let's, why not coffee?
Yeah.
Okay. Then how do you find, I mean, it's not like there's coffee plants growing in Waconia, which is a lovely place.
Yeah.
How do you go about finding the supplier? I mean, all of that is a tremendous mm-hmm. investment in, I would imagine, not just time, but money as well.
Right. And I'll let Steve take that question. It was funny, though. We started out big. Steve presented me with this idea that we needed to have a coffee truck that showed the awareness piece. And it's a great plan and whatever. But then we were like, wait a minute, coffee truck. Okay, what do we need to have a coffee truck? Oh, we should learn about coffee. I mean, we've kept having to
probably
backwards to figure this thing out. So, but yeah, we do have a good source for coffee, and Steve can share.
Right, and the coffee truck looks very. So, do you drive around and give out samples, and then hope people order from you?
Well, and we don't have our coffee truck. That's our dream.
Oh, okay. So we're still working on the coffee truck, yeah.
Yeah, right now we're just online, and we have a booth that we just had our first event today.
Okay.
We were at Tour de Tonka, and we were there at, what time was it, Brandy? 3:45 we got out of bed, and we were there by 5 a.m.
Okay.
You're probably used to getting up early, though.
Yeah. But I'm just looking at the mock-up, because it looks, I mean, the mock-up of the truck looks great.
Yeah.
But what was the reception? Did people sort of seem to understand what you were doing?
So here's, I should probably back up and kind of share with you a little bit of where that came from. So I'm in advertising, I'm a graphic designer, art director, and so, you know, when you go out and, you know, I'm used to doing these pitches, you know, so you go into companies and you have a presentation and a pitch. And I thought, you know, as I'm thinking about, okay, how can we make an impact? Because there's such a need in so many of these places that we've been, these really impoverished slums. And I'm not a very good person. I'm horrible at asking favors from anybody, and especially for funds or money. And I thought, you know, we could make money. I mean, look at all the coffee shops that are popping up, and, you know, and food trucks have been really a trendy thing for a while. And, you know, I thought, as I'm thinking for really, I took like three mornings and just thought, okay, I'm going to just try to dive into this thing, and what can I do? And this was revealed to me that, why don't you build a truck? And it's not just a truck to make money and sell goods. It's actually an awareness piece. So you could actually take this thing to events where people maybe have the same mindset as you, and really just show what the vision is through video. And so that's something I'm pretty familiar with as well. And so it's much more than just selling coffee. It was this awareness piece to it. And so then I pitched it to my wife. I thought, you know, if I just throw this at her and she's, you know, just talking through it, she's not going to buy into it. So I had to create a whole PowerPoint and said, this is what I want. This is what I'm envisioning. What do you think? And I think it kind of took her back a bit when I first presented it.
But and how long have you actually been selling coffee? Because, you know, you can go on to, and the website is javarelief.com, and you can go and the coffee looks great. How long have you actually been selling?
Yeah, the coffee is excellent. It's we've only been since May, so it's really new, and as we're, but it's been really well received, like unbelievably well received, and yeah, it's just kind of like we thought, how much inventory do we, once we launch this site, how much do we get? And we're super conservative, but yet I felt like, you know what, this is just new. You know, maybe I think we bought like 120, like we just roast 120 bags. Let's hit launch.
And do you do the roasting?
No, we have a partner with two roasters, and they have a job too, and now that's what their job is, and so you can't just say, okay, I need 120 bags of coffee delivered tomorrow. You know, it's like you got to do some guessing as to how much traffic you're going to get on your website. And we missed it because we just, like, it just poured in.
Really?
Started some social media stuff and just kind of kicked off some campaigns, you know, through Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and then some email blasts.
And so you're saying all of the profits are going to these charitable causes, you know, children's causes, you know, mm-hmm. in third world countries or impoverished countries. Let me ask you, I mean, how much this had to be an initial outlay, though. I assume that are you able to cover your expenses?
Well, we did put some of our own money in so that we could get started.
We'd have to,
because
you got to buy the coffee.
But we don't have to pay for marketing and advertising because that's something I do. So that's a huge part, right?
Right.
The logo and you see the website. I mean, to build a website.
So you were able to kind of design the website.
Yeah.
Design and build it. Yeah.
Okay, because it's obviously a professional looking website, and you're obviously a professional. So I see what you're saying. So otherwise you would have had to have hired somebody to design this kind of a website.
Yeah. And then, because I am clueless about how to start a business, I reached out to a friend of ours. Really, he was an acquaintance. We hadn't probably talked to him for 10 years, but I knew he was in a accounting and law firm. And I reached out to him and I said, can you just even help me at all about how to start this business? And his company, Boulay, which is on our website, totally took it for us and did the work.
And,
pro bono. Yeah.
Pro bono. Just really, really excellent help.
Awesome.
Wow. Okay. And so you had your first public event. So where do you go from here?
So, we tested that out today, and the Tour de Tonka. I'm thinking Nickel Dickel Day in Waconia is coming up, but Tour de Tonka had 3,500 riders and about 600 volunteers there, and we just thought, well, we'll see what happens. And so, you know, again, we put a lot of time and effort into creating this really cool branded booth, and we blew through all our inventory and couldn't keep up with the demand. So we're learning. But it was a success, and it seems like people were really inquisitive because we had these cards. So, you know, if somebody's thinking about these things as we're talking. So we had, you know, you go to an event like a bike race, everybody has a bag and they have flyers in there. And so we made one of those, and it talked about our business. We gave them a coupon for free shipping, and we talked about it, and people would come to our booth and they would say, okay, what's the deal? All volunteer, 100% profits go to children at risk. It's like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And said, well, you know, it's, I have to keep working. This is my wife can do this full time, and we'll see if she gets burned out doing it. But so far, Brandy, I'm speaking for you. It seems like she's really enjoying it.
Well, I guess it's the coffee looks like the 12-ounce bags are $11.95, mm-hmm. which I mm-hmm. think is obviously comparable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go on to the website, javarelief.com, mm-hmm. and just shop. So,
yeah. Esme, you asked, you know, where do we go from here? Our biggest thing would be to have the truck. So that's what we're hoping for. And, you know, somebody out there is going to believe in us and what we're doing, and they're going to say, hey, I'm going to come alongside you. We just believe it. And we're praying for that it will just be it'll just happen. And then we'll be able to drive around and do all these events way easier than we do right now.
With your booth that you probably have to transport everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the rules that come along with having beverages at a stand and stuff like that. So And then also for the children that I think it's an important point to know, with 100% of our profits going to children, we have such great contacts around the world with people that we trust, nationals that we trust, that take the money and do with it what they've said they need to do with it. And that's huge, that we know exactly where the money's going.
The boots on the ground.
Well, that is so important, because having been a reporter for so many years, it is unbelievable to me that people will use people and take advantage of people's generosity for false or fraudulent purposes.
Yeah.
So to know that you really know that money is really going to a child and really helping is fabulous. I mean, it's fabulous
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing that is so exciting for us, is to be able to share with people what their money has gone for, to be able to share the stories of these children, like the girl that you mentioned who has the patch of skin removed from her eye, and to be able to have follow-up on these kids and let everybody else hear, oh, we were part of that. That's huge.
Yeah, and you got some good coffee.
Yeah, we do.
There. Well, listen, I want to give you out the name of the website again, javarelief.com. And they're up and running. They're selling coffee. All the profits go to help kids that are impoverished, that have different medical problems, and that need help, that really, really desperately need help. And it's been founded by Brandy and Steve Seward from Waconia. So congratulations, folks, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Esme.
Okay, well, and we'll have to have you on at a later date to see how much more coffee you're selling.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
Great.
All right.
Appreciate
thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, what a cool idea. But again, that website, javarelief.com, and the 12-ounce bags, they've got all different kinds of coffee, all different kinds of roasts, $11.95, which is competitive if you're looking at the fancy coffees of this world, and it's all going to a good cause. Okay, folks, I'll be with you until 9 o'clock. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we've got, of course, David Schultz, and then really interesting story coming up in our next half hour, kind of something akin to the Bernie Madoff. And I'll talk to you right after the break about that. But keep it here, News Radio 830 WCC. It is 7:28 in the Twin Cities, 65 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Coming up in our 8 o'clock hour, we're going to chat with Professor David Schultz about his ostrich egg. It's a very interesting story. I'm not sure I get the whole thing, but he actually has a pretty well-known coffee shop that is going to cook his ostrich eggs for him on Tuesday. I don't know if I can say the name of it, but maybe we'll find out. But anyway, he's getting it professionally cooked. And an ostrich egg is about the size of like two dozen hen eggs. So that's a big egg. It's a big egg. And then we're going to talk politics, and just chatting in the break with Jonathan. You know, it's really not so much politics as, and I was talking to my friend Pat, opera. It's just every
way to put it.
Every day there's something.
I call it a circus, but soap opera, I think, is pretty accurate.
It's so with the Scaramucci firing, and it's just what story was I on? And I can't even remember. They're all blending together, and we got the conference
what
call.
Happens.
I know. I know what it was. I was talking last Sunday. I had on as my guest Lindell, who obviously is the founder of MyPillow, and he is a huge Donald Trump supporter. He was saying last summer he's going to win. Trust me, he's going to win. I was like, yeah, right. Like, Mike Lindell is absolutely correct. Mr. Trump did win. But one of the people that he was really good friends with was Anthony Scaramucci, that they'd known each other and they text back and forth. And this was like Sunday, and I think he got fired Monday. So I asked, I said, what's he like? And Mike Lindell was saying, you know, what nice he was, and how, you know, this was despite the profanity-laced rant
that he had in the New Yorker.
But anyway, yeah, it was – but just what a great guy he is, how he picks up the check, and he's just really super wonderful. And
so here's
– a day later, he's out.
This is, we need soap opera music. Sort of like the Minnesota Hospital music that comes on.
Oh,
every
I
year
love
at the
Minnesota
fair,
Hospital,
which is coming up.
Dave Lee is a genius. You've got to listen to his. Is it usually the first Thursday of the fair?
No. It'll be both Fridays.
Both Fridays.
Both
of the fair.
Fridays.
So good. He is a great comedy writer. A great writer.
We need to get either that sort of music or some sort of soap opera-esque music to talk about the latest episode of As the Trump Turns, because basically he brought in Scaramucci to be the quote-unquote hitman, and then
he gets
a week and a half later, he gets proverbially whacked.
Right.
What is this, people?
Scaramucci tell people like he's not a backstabber, he's a front stabber. So you know when he's coming at you. Anyway, we'll talk to Dave Schultz about all that because it is unbelievable. All right, and then coming up after we're going to have to take a break for weather. I'm a little getting by myself here, but then we're going to talk with an author. Janet Lombardi has written a memoir called Bankruptcy, A Love Story. And it's a true story. What happens to a woman after her husband commits a white-collar crime to cover up substantial debt is prosecuted and winds up in prison. That's coming up in our next half hour.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 7:37 in the Twin Cities. Well, I hope you have a vacation planned coming up. So many of us do in August. And one of the things I love doing on vacation is getting a good book to read, something that really moves, that has an incredible story. And you can go with fiction, or you can go with nonfiction, or you can go with a nonfiction story that almost seems like it's not real. And I think that that's something that almost really fits with the description of this next author's book. This is a true story. Janet Lombardi is author of Bankruptcy, A Love Story. And I'm just going to read you a quote from one of the releases that we got on it. For Janet Lombardi, the biopic Wizard of Lies, which of course is about Bernie Madoff and the books that have been written about Madoff, hit pretty close to home, or way too close to home. And this is a quote from Janet. My husband, an attorney, committed a white-collar crime to cover up substantial debt, and I had no idea, she says. He was prosecuted, disbarred, and wound up in prison. I was left with shame and financial ruin. Janet Lombardi has written the book, and again, it's available everywhere books are sold, Bankruptcy, A Love Story. And it is it's a very compelling read. Janet, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. You had a wonderful life. I mean, you know, your husband, you thought, was doing really well financially.
That's right. We lived a nice middle-class life. I wouldn't say it was an extravagant life by any means, but we enjoyed our home on a tree-lined street in a suburb outside of New York City. And we had two children, which, thank goodness, we still have. And, you know, we lived a comfortable life.
Very comfortable, and just homes and suburbs of New York City are that's not a cheap thing at all. A nice home. And suddenly, first of all, how, because I don't want to give away everything, but so you're living this very comfortable life, which I think is the perfect way to describe it. How did you find out?
That's a great question. I certainly had a sense that the finances were kind of nosediving, but I didn't have any idea really how bad it was until the end of 2006, actually the beginning of 2007, just before the country, remember, was about to undergo their own financial mess in 2008 when everything kind of had a meltdown. I called my financial advisor, Chris, to ask him why we hadn't received our year-end statements. You know, at the time, we were still receiving paper statements. And his response to me was, you'd better get yourself a good lawyer, a good accountant, and a private eye. And that certainly got my attention because I just got kind of terrified after hearing that because I realized that there was something terribly wrong.
So, what did Chris know?
Well, Chris knew that my husband had emptied some of our accounts including his own IRA. He had been taking money out, siphoning money out. I didn't have any idea that he was doing that. So that obviously alarmed me and you know, had me realize that there was something very wrong, that he hadn't come to me and told me. But after that, I did confront him. I confronted my husband, and he said that he was tapped out. And I kind of went into our finances in a way that I hadn't before, which is a really important part of the story and certainly a cautionary tale, that I hadn't really looked at everything. I didn't look at the insurance levels. I didn't look at the mortgage. I didn't look at things. And it wasn't
because he handled it.
He handled some of it. I mean, it wasn't like I was completely in the dark either. I had been handling our household finances, but there was a lot of it that he was handling. And so I took a very, very deep dive into it, kind of excavating it, as I like to call it, because that's what it was like and that's what it felt like. And what I found was that there were, you know, several hundred thousand dollars in debt, business line, and, you know, it was way worse than I thought it was. And also at the time, I didn't know that there would eventually be a prosecution, and my husband was incarcerated for a white-collar crime because he had been also taking money from clients through the client's escrow. You know, he had an attorney's account, so I did not know that a lot of those transactions, I didn't know any of them actually were going, I didn't know that those transactions were occurring. So it was a huge financial mess. I ended up, you know, having to sell my house and eventually moved in with my sister. You know, when we separated, he went to prison. I went to live with my sister and brother-in-law for about 2 years, which I didn't think that was going to be that long. I thought it would be a couple of months because at that point I had two kids in college and wanted to be able to pay their tuition and not have to take them out of school.
And this is obviously, I mean, anybody listening to this, it's a harrowing situation. When you went back and looked at it, how long was he doing this?
Well, he had been doing it for, I think it was about, by that point, I'd say about 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, I didn't really know until I took a look at the credit reports, among other things. He did give me permission to look at his credit report, and I looked at them, and it was pretty frightening because there was so much debt. And interestingly, as I describe in the book, Bankruptcy Love Story, that he still had access to a huge credit line. So
it was getting worse.
It could be getting worse, right? It could be getting worse.
Yeah, and it's so interesting, you know. And obviously, this story, hitting it around 2007, because, there are so many stories where things started unraveling in 2007, and obviously you had the ultimate collapse in 2008. But there were so many people who were exposed. Where it was sort of an actual Ponzi scheme or else, shifting accounts around, because it
Absolutely.
Got to a point where you couldn't hide it anymore because everybody was being tapped out or worried about their money. And it was just the tension was building,
Totally. Yeah.
2007 and 2008. In terms of, and so you were blindsided by this, but then you go through this process of uncovering it and unraveling it, and you realize not only do you not have the money you thought you had, you're significantly in debt. You've got, the
right.
two kids in college. How did you, how did you even begin to kind of recover or deal with it or even get up in
yeah.
the morning? I mean,
that's a good question. One thing I want to say before I answer that question is that, interestingly, what I did in the book was detail and describe what it was like to be in a family where these kinds of things were occurring. I really hadn't seen any books that were being written about, this kind of, serious complications. We were seeing the headlines, right? And the headlines were startling. All kinds of things were collapsing around us financially in this country, but where were the stories? So this is a story. In terms of how I kind of dealt with it, it was devastating emotionally. But one of the things that I needed to do and did do was kind of separate the emotion from the logic at one point. I felt that I needed to get out of the mess. I wanted to get my clean, kind of, you know. And so I had a plan for myself, and I set steps, and I treated it almost like a punch list that I would, you know, divest the house was number one, because even though I loved my home and it was emotionally devastating. I didn't want to leave my home. We had just renovated the house, and I described that in the book how, you know, we were kind of building this life together. But I did make the decision to sell the house so I could get out of that very ugly mortgage. There was a timeshare that I divested. There was other credit card debt that needed to be taken care of, including a credit line that my husband had used for business that had my name attached to it. So So I kind of took the emotion. I didn't spend a lot of time wringing my hands, but I decided to kind of jump into action.
All right. We're chatting right now with Janet Lombardi. She is the author of Bankruptcy, A Love Story. Again, the title Bankruptcy, A Love Story, because I'm sure there are people out there who are thinking maybe not all of this happened, but some parts of it did, in fact. And I have also known people whose spouses or loved ones have gone to prison, and you write about that as well, because at first you didn't think it was going to go that far. You just thought you were in really bad financial straits.
That's right. That's right. No, I had no idea that was going to happen. But again, things were unraveling, and I was discovering things. It wasn't as if my husband was coming to me and telling me these things. So that's kind of part of the story, is just my kind of looking at the files and seeing things that I had no idea about. I discovered that he was going to be prosecuted when I lifted the cover of our photocopier at home. We had a home office, and on the glass of the photocopier was the Bar Association investigating him. So I picked up the paper and looked at it and just knew that this was it. This was the end of him. I knew he was going to get disbarred. And so that was really, you know, an indication to me that things were going to be changing here, seriously, and that I had to step up and continue to step up and take control of my life and my children's lives.
And what was it like? So you find the thing on the copier and you realize this is a whole different level there. What is that like to cope with? And you've got kids, and to go through that process of having your husband be prosecuted.
Right.
And sent to prison.
Well, it was horrifying, as you can imagine. And certainly what I never expected for my own life and for his life and our family's life. It was horrifying. But I also had to make kind of a turn in that, because I needed to detach myself emotionally so that I could function. I couldn't, I couldn't go about my life paralyzed with fear, which I was on many levels, and certainly I had many, long, dark nights. But I really needed to get my emotions out of it and recognize that I had a right to survive. I had a responsibility to survive and to help my children, and that I had no knowledge of this. So I was certainly not responsible for any of it. But there was a lot of, I would say collateral shame, if you will, just being associated with that. But the other thing that was happening was I was kind of sorting out my own feelings. Well, how did I feel about him? You know, I had this marriage of 25 years, so obviously I had a very deep bond of love, which in the book is another theme, is love. And love kind of travels through the book, because it doesn't necessarily go away just because you find out something about someone. For me, anyway, somebody else may have had a very different reaction. So I had to kind of reconcile my feelings about how I felt about him, the marriage, the family, a new life that I needed to face. And it was emotional turmoil.
Well, and I think that's what's so interesting, because even, you know, for those people who can relate to some part of your story, I think that there are many people who have confronted, you know, devastating setbacks, whether it's, you know, emotional or financial. And so it's compounded. And, you know, also you've got to be there for the kids, too, because this obviously was not easy for them. I mean, their whole lives were upended.
Exactly. At that point, my children were older, so it was, I think, a little bit easier. But what I wanted to do, even though they were in college, I still wanted to protect them and keep their lives going and not have to make any changes in their lives. So in some respects, you know, their lives were kind of protected. Mine was very different. As I said, I had to sell my house. I had to figure out where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do. But they were, you know, pretty supportive of their dad in that they, you know, went to visit him, and we certainly kept ourselves together as a family to some extent. I did eventually, you know, get a divorce, and you know, so now we're friends.
Wow. All right. Well, it is a remarkable story. Janet Lombardi, thank you so much for joining us. Again, folks, the name of the book is Bankruptcy, A Love Story. Again, Bankruptcy, A Love Story. Thank you so much for sharing, and it's a fascinating read.
Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Again, it's, you know, I think a lot of people can see parts of themselves in this book, and it's, you know, as she was saying, you know, nobody had written a book about it from the inside perspective. So I think that's definitely a unique perspective. All right, well, we do have to take a quick break. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 7:54 in the Twin Cities, 65 degrees. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. On deck, we've got Professor David Schultz. So much to talk about with him. Chatting with Jonathan, it's kind of like a soap opera these days with the political scene. And one of the things that, you know, I really love about talking with him is not only does he have sort of the political analysis, but he also has obviously he's a law professor, and we'll talk to him about the fact that there is now a grand jury in this case. I mean, what does that mean? What impact does that have? I've seen some estimates saying the grand jury could meet for 18 months. I mean, that seems like it's forever. The situation clearly is not going away, folks. We're going to be dealing with this for a very long time. So I want to ask him about that. And then I also want to ask him about, he had a little ostrich egg, rendezvous. And he actually has gotten somebody who has a chain of really wonderful cafes is going to cook the ostrich egg. Although I don't know how you get a pan that's big enough for the ostrich egg, because what I read, and I Googled it after he explained this to me, one ostrich egg is equal to like two dozen hen eggs. So think about that. You know, you got a pan, you're trying to like fry up a dozen eggs. I mean, that's got to be a pretty big pan, but no, you're frying up two dozen eggs. And what does it taste like? I don't know. I just think the whole thing is, well, I don't know. We'll ask him about it and see why he's doing this. Also want to put in a plug for WCCO-TV Sunday morning. We will have all the latest on all these stories, including the firebombing of that mosque in Bloomington. We also will have an update on the latest in that Minnehaha investigation, because obviously a lot of people still concerned about that. Again, thank you to Chief Brian Tyner from the Minneapolis Fire Department, who was kind enough to come in and talk about what that was like responding to that scene. He was saying it was the worst natural gas explosion he had seen in his 22 years in the department. So we'll have updates on all those things. Micah Gustnack will be there. We also will have live at 10:30. We'll have Senator Al Franken, a lot to talk about with him tomorrow on WCCO television, and also Dean Phillips, who is a likely candidate to run against Congressman Eric Paulson in 2018. So keep it here, folks. You are listening to the one and only News Radio 830 WCCO.